This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome back. This is Lana, and I'm delighted to have you here. Joining me is Elizabeth Holgrave, who is an independent researcher of pre-Christian European spiritual traditions. She studied Judeo-Christian religion, Kabbalah, traditional witchcraft, and the ancestral traditions and pre-Christian spiritual practices of the Celtic and Germanic peoples in a lifelong search for her spiritual roots. Sit back and relax because you're going to enjoy this one. Welcome, Elizabeth. How are you this evening?
Oh, I'm doing good. Had a little glass of mead here to get started on talking about Germanic heathenism.
Perfect. Very fitting. So how did your family end up in America?
Oh, wow. So most of my ancestors came over here during the 1600s and the first wave, really. I had some come over with the kind of with the Mayflower group, but on different ships to Salem. And others came through Delaware and then settled in Ohio. And they were primarily of German and Swiss descent. And I also had French Huguenot ancestors that came over from escaping Catholic persecution there, who came over as indentured servants here and had to work off their servitude, and Irish also.
Were they ever freed? Because, you know, some indentured servants were enslaved their whole life and they had horrible lives. People think, oh, it was just easy. They had it easy, which is not true at all.
No, it's not. They actually, I don't think it was too bad for them. It was probably your basic contract where they actually just kind of, you know, I think one was a cabinet maker and, you know, did his time, you know, as an indentured servant and also training, I think, as an apprentice to become a cabinet maker. That was part of the heritage of the French Huguenot family. So no, I don't have any horror stories, really.
Well, that's good.
But they did, they left behind all their, you know, estates in France and had to come actually first to England and then over here.
Yeah, so has your family been good of keeping records and passing that along to the children?
Not exactly. I pretty much did, like, all the genealogical research for my family, myself, and my grandmother knew about three generations back, and then I, using Ancestry.com and also the Mormon site, was able to research back past the Middle Ages, basically, and yeah.
Yeah, I've done some digging, too, and I can't, the farthest back I can go is Russian Orthodox.
Right? Like,
come on, what were we before that, you know?
And exactly.
You ask your grandparents, and they just are, they have this confused look on their face, you know?
Yeah.
Well, before we dive into Germanic heathenism, tell us about your path that brought you back to Germanic heathenism, because in reality, you are returning to it.
Yeah, that's true. Wow, I pretty much had your basic Protestant Christian upbringing that I think a lot of people here in America who have European descent and others can identify with. And when I was about 12 years old, that was the age my mother explained to me was the age of accountability, where you had to decide, finally, if you accepted Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. So knowing nothing else, of course, was very excited, and I did. I filled out a small little booklet where you say this little prayer and say that you sign a little contract saying that you accept him as your Savior. And after that happened, I was a very inquisitive child, and I was really excited about my religion, and I already knew a lot about your basic Christianity that you learn in church. But I was really filled with a passion to learn more. And so I started really studying the Bible and really researching Middle Eastern mythology in an attempt to learn more. And what happened is I started finding references to Sumerian and Babylonian mythology where they talk about the same myths but with multiple gods. And so I went to my mother and asked her about this. You know, why do they have the Garden of Eden here and you have multiple gods? And you know, Adapa, and I forget her name, but Adam and Eve are created at the same time, and I was very excited with this new information, and my mother didn't really know any better, but she said, well, don't ask questions, the devil makes you ask questions.
Oh, jeez.
So that was just really struck a chord in me, and just, I realized that, wait, my inquiry, you know, my inquisitiveness was being, I was being told to shut it off and just to believe, and it really wasn't good enough for me, and I basically went to the one place that anyone at that age went to for other answers, which was the New Age section of the bookstore.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how I got into Wicca, which is, I think, kind of the gateway religion for anyone who's coming from a Christian background and is looking for deeper answers.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the Wiccan witches I met, they're still these very much these lefty feminist types, and I feel like they're doing it just to rebel against their Christian parents, so it's not even really that sincere, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I do know what you mean. And they kind of fall into it with the same fervor, and you end up basically psychologically taking all the damage that you've accrued by being a Christian and just applying it to this new kind of format, which is also why I think that they really gravitate towards the opposite. So instead of having a domineering god in the sky, it's all the goddess, you know, it's all about feminism, empowerment, and, you know, not even much mention of, you know, what they call the god in their mythology, you know.
Yeah. So why did paganism speak to you?
The way it actually happened, it's funny. I found this book, which a lot of people, you know, critique because the research isn't, you know, perfectly done. But, you know, at that time, it did help me. It was Celtic Magic by DJ Conway. And now I don't recommend this book, but at the time it helped me because it was my first exposure to reading about pagan mythology and pagan gods. And this was the Irish tradition. And the reason it spoke to me is because I'd always felt a deep connection with nature. I felt most spiritually fulfilled when I was out in nature, singing to the trees as a child and things like that. And Christianity really didn't give that to me. So here I was reading from these Wiccan authors that the divine is in nature and that it was okay to feel that way, learning about, you know, the fairies, which they presented as these little diminutive beings, which I know now is not true. I felt like that kind of just felt more natural. You know, they were about the seasons and, you know, just kind of not the sick, twisted idea of sin and that there's something inherently wrong with you.
Mm. Oh, yeah. And then there's a lot of Christians that are worried about when you talk about this, being in tune with nature. That's earth worship. That's of the devil.
Right. That's idolism. That's, you know, earth. Who's the lord of the earth? It's Satan, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the word heathen has been demonized after Christianity to mean an uncivilized or unenlightened barbaric person. So setting Christian disinfo aside, what did it really mean to be a heathen?
Well, I guess I didn't know that term at that time, you know, I was Wiccan for a long time, and kind of, I feel like that's kind of a trap that people can fall into, because what it took me time to realize when I looked on my bookshelves, and basically people who have had experience with Wicca will know what I'm talking about, when I saw the symbol for this one publisher all across my bookshelf and realized that all these books were coming from the same publisher, and with my insatiable search for knowledge, I wasn't satisfied with just reading these books. I had to go to the sources and start reading the actual, you know, Jacob Grimm's Germanic mythology, things like that, the Tan Bó Cúalnge of the Irish tradition, and, you know, the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda by Snorri Sturluson. And I was starting to see a pattern here where the things the Wiccan authors were saying, that they were the oldest religion and how the ancients used to worship, they weren't jiving with what I was reading in these actual scholarly books. And it was at that point that I kind of gave it up for a while and didn't really know what to do with it. I was reading these stories. They really, you know, spoke to me, but they didn't mix with the Wiccan. Basically, Wicca is started by Gerald Gardner, and he was a Mason and a friend with Aleister Crowley. He really didn't have a whole lot to do with actual pre-Christian pagan traditions. And I'm not exactly answering your question, but later on, the word heathen felt like an empowering word, kind of like people who try to reclaim the word witch, because the Judeo-Christian construct really is designed to disempower you, to make you reject all the things that in the past our ancestors held as dear, like strength, you know, pride in your accomplishments, you know, a sense of self-interest, preserving yourself and being independent. And so, yeah, the word heathen, I like it now. I see it as reclaiming a word saying, yes, that, you know, you're going to call me a barbarian. I'm not a barbarian. I believe in the traditions of my ancestors who were far, far from barbaric, way less barbaric than, in my opinion, than the Roman Catholic Church has been throughout the ages.
Oh, of course. So who were the original heathens?
The original heathens would be our ancestors before Christianity came to their lands. And what they actually practiced was an earth-centered spirituality. And it arises out of your intuition, it arises out of an instinctive connection to nature. And you know, I by no means consider myself to be an expert on this, but from what I've read and how I feel about it, it seems to me that this started from probably veneration of the dead, veneration of the ancestors. And to get a little spooky here and a little less scholarly, I myself have had personal experience where I have felt spirits. I've had concrete experiences where, thankfully, I know that they do exist after death. And I believe these people had those experiences. And when a loved one had gone beyond, they wanted to keep honoring them. And in some cases, you had men, women who were very extraordinary individuals who really amassed a lot of knowledge in their life, really gave something to their people. And in those cases, they would become the gods. And just for an example, Woden or Odin, who most heathens know, in the Heimskringla, they considered him to be, which is the genealogy of the kings, they considered him to be their ancestor, and they believed that they were descended from him, and that Woden had actually been a man, a great man who lived, who was possibly a king and a shaman at the same time. And so, you know, it starts as veneration of the dead, and they become gods, and they guide and help their people from the beyond. That's where I think it came from.
Well, what Christians do then in some regard, I mean, they hear you talk about that venerating dead, you know, it's so spooky, but aren't they doing that if they think Jesus is real or these saints are real and they're venerating them every year during their holidays? Isn't that pretty much the same thing?
It pretty much is. And actually, in most cases, the saints are the old gods in a lot of lands because that's how they would convert them. The Christians would go into an area and these people were not quick to put aside their old ways. And so what they would do is they would turn these people into saints. In the Irish example, Saint Bridget is a perfect example. She was the Brid, an Irish goddess. And so they basically created a nice little saint's life for her. Now they said she was a, you know, very devout Christian who would become a saint. You can keep practicing all your pagan rituals, but now you're going to the church to do it. You're praying to Saint Bridget, right?
It's just amazing that, I mean, how old is paganism? It could be, you know, more than 40,000 years old, 150,000 years old, and then here comes Christianity, was a couple thousand years old, and it just, bam, just took hold of the world.
Yeah, here comes Christianity.
It just amazes me.
From these.
Yeah, I mean, it predates everything. Islam, Christianity, Buddhism.
It really does, and even though we're talking about European and specifically Germanic heathenism tonight, my belief is that I think there's a call for people to return to their earth-based traditions, regardless of what your culture is. And, you know, if you look at every single culture on the planet and you really look back, most have traditions that are based on the earth, based on the ancestors, veneration of nature. I mean, you have Santeria for the Latin American peoples. You have Voodoo and the beautiful African traditions for African peoples. You have Shinto in Japan, you know, and even the Chinese used to have a really beautiful pagan tradition that was destroyed by communist China. Mm. So, you know, there's a lot of talk these days about diversity being our strength and multiculturalism. But what I see is a great hypocrisy because it seems that they just want to cut everybody off from the roots, blend everybody together. When for me, diversity really could be our strength if we really reconnect with these traditions and become a nation of a world of people who are connected to their ancestral roots, proud of their individual nations, and then able to come together and share your acquired knowledge, you know, for the betterment of the planet.
We have to reclaim that word diversity because it is anything but diverse out there right now.
It's not oneversity. I don't know the word for it. Monoversity. There you go.
Yeah, but you're right. There's other cultures around the world that still venerate their ancestors. And then I see some white people that go to these third world countries and they see that and say, oh, it's so beautiful. And it's like, well, we used to venerate our dead too before you cut yourself off from it, you know? And we should do this to cultivate values and knowledge. It's kinship to pass it along through our family lineage. I mean, knowledge of the natural world and their place in it. It's classic and it never goes out of date, wouldn't you say?
I would definitely say that. I think it comes naturally to the human condition. Even a Christian, you know, it's sad to see Christian friends of mine who have someone who has died, and they feel that they can't, you know, they're forbidden. If they've really studied their Bibles, they are forbidden to talk to the dead. They're not supposed to do that. They're only supposed to speak to Jesus, to God. And when I say something to them, like, they're right there. Just talk to them. You know, it's just kind of this sadness I see in their eyes where they just don't understand because you're not allowed to do that.
Yeah, what are some more important traditions or beliefs within Germanic heathenism? We touched upon the nature aspect, but what else is there?
Well, there's one of the things that you have to do when you cut yourself off from, when you start relearning this stuff, is you have to unlearn all the programming that's been done to you. So in Germanic heathenism, for one example, your approach to the divine is very different than that of Christianity or any other Abrahamic religion. You're not going to the gods groveling and supplicating before this mighty being, you know, begging them to please interact with this filthy, sin-filled human being and help you. You're meeting, I wouldn't say on an equal ground, but you're meeting them, honoring them, and asking their help because they have more experience than you. You know, they're more wise than you. And so you're making a kind of a more equal exchange there. And another one is that the virtues of heathenism. In Asatru, they call them the nine noble virtues. And those are, I'll just say what they are.
Yeah,
they're
great.
Courage, truth, honor, fidelity, discipline, hospitality, industriousness, self-reliance, and perseverance. And just by examining those words by themselves, you can see, what are some of these that probably aren't encouraged that much in Christianity? Well, I definitely can point out a few. Courage, self-reliance, and perseverance, unless it's, you know, perseverance with the word that you've read. I think that heathenism encourages you to rely on yourself, to be strong, not to be a victim. You kind of take the role in Christianity as you're kind of a slave to it. Mm. Whereas, you know, in heathenism, you're called to be strong. You're called to cultivate all of your strengths, and you're called to, you know, be true to yourself, be true to others, to honor your ancestors, honor your family, your tribe. Just a few things. Hospitality is a big one. That's something that's not really covered in Christianity, but that's basically the concept that, you know, if you have a guest in your house, for example, that they have basically you're responsible for their welfare and they are safe with you. And it's very important that you first offer them drink to make them welcome. And yeah, it's a big focus on just the traditions of our peoples, you know, and just the little customs, the little things that connect you to the seasons, that connect you to the gods, that I think are really beautiful.
Yeah, and you said a word that a lot of people forget about, self-reliance. You got to take care of yourself and be your own master. Yeah, I mean, I've heard stories of Christians praying over gas tanks, praying for God to fill it up. And it's like, there's only one way that's going to get full. You have to go work, you have to make some money, and then you have to go to the gas station.
Exactly. There's an often quoted, I don't know where it comes from, but it actually does not come from the Bible, phrase that some Christians love to say, God helps those who help themselves. Well, I would almost venture to wonder, does this come from pagan times? Because it's not biblical. And, you know, the heathen gods, they won't help someone who lets their life fall into complete ruin, who's a slacker, you know, doesn't give a damn about anybody else, and then all of a sudden wants their help. You know, it's like you just look at the Grimm's fairy tales, which kind of encode in a secret way to pass on to the people at a time when they were dealing with Christianity, the old ethics of their pagan ancestors. And one of the recurring themes there is that, you know, Rumpelstiltskin, for example, you know, these elves, these beings, they will help the people who are really industrious, who are trying really hard anyway. So, you know, the young girl, she's spinning and spinning and trying to create all that thread, and so then she gets the help of the elf. You know, if she's not industrious, she gets left behind. She doesn't get helped. So, multiple themes like that.
So who were some of the gods and goddesses?
Well, with Germanic heathenisms, you have basically one pantheon that's kind of the names are different depending on what region you go to. So most people are familiar with the Scandinavian names, which would be typically Odin, Thor, Frey, Freya, Sif, Thor's wife, Frigg, Odin's wife. I hate to say his name, but Loki. he's the, you know, bringer of mischief and ruin in a lot of cases. But, you know, and then if you go into more Germanic, which for some reason I have more of a resonance with, maybe because I feel like there's some hidden older knowledge there, you would have the equivalent would be Woden, Thunor, and I don't think they have a Loki really. But yeah, those will be the gods. They believe in two different types of gods, the Aesir and the Vanir. So the Aesir would be kind of what I talked about earlier. Those would be the deified ancestors that, you know, they symbolize things like excellence in magic, poetry, battle, you know, household skills, things like that. Whereas the Vanir gods, which would be, I should clarify here. For example, the Aesir gods would be Odin, Thor, and Frigg, whereas the Vanir gods, for example, you would have Frey and Freya. But the Vanir gods typify more the forces within nature. Earth forces, water forces, kind of that kind of thing. And then you have what are referred to as the giants, and those are basically and considered to be an ancient race of beings that symbolize very primal forces in nature that often manifest in a chaotic way. Thor is known by most people through the movie as the defender of man. What he does is he wards off the power of the giants and protects men within the world of Midgard.
Hmm. Now, animism is also a big part of this, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Animism is, I think, inherent to most people, even as a child. You know, you think that objects have feelings. You know, it feels like, you know, when I was a kid, I remember thinking that everything around me was aware of itself. And that's what animism is. Stones, trees, rivers, they have a personality, and we kind of anthropomorphize that into a human form for our subconscious minds to kind of deal with that power that we're interacting with.
Why do you think we're not seeing... I was thinking the other day, I watched Grimm. It's this horrible TV show. Have you heard of it?
Oh, yes, I have.
It's supposed to be loosely based on the stories published by the Brothers Grimm. And it's like, there's... I didn't see one German name attached to it, but there's a lot of Jewish people in there. And in fact,
of course.
They made a bar mitzvah comment in one of the first few episodes. But why do you think a lot of these stories with folklore, legends, Scandinavian, Germanic, Slavic, how come these aren't being incorporated into movies?
That is a good question. And I've thought that so many times when I would read these old myths and I would think, my God, these would make such amazing movies. But the thing is that they do it, right? What they do is they do it and they twist it and cartoonify it. And like you said, like in that show, and I think it's a way to subtly denigrate them on a subconscious level and to make us think that there is no value in them. Disney comes to mind, for example.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It's a war tactic. They do not want Europeans to connect to something old because they know that they would be waking a giant. a giant that's going to be very mad when he wakes up. Yeah, speaking of Thor, again, there was a, why not find a Nordic girl to play in that role, but they had a Jewish girl play the role, you know?
They had the beautiful Israeli Natalie Portman.
Yeah, because Nordic women aren't beautiful, right?
No, we all know that. They're all whip-wielding SS officers. It's frightening women with big, strong jaws, right? No, I mean, the Thor movie was really funny to me. It was nice on the one hand to see them kind of put those myths out there, but they did it such a disservice on so many important levels. And just one I'd like to point out is that, you know, Thor is this, you know, young blonde man, you know, and his friend, it really struck me that his friend, the one who's more burly with the big red beard, when I saw him, I thought, that's Thor. That's him. Why don't they have the this guy play Thor? But no, I mean, I think I wonder about the motives of Disney if you go back, you know, because these myths, you know, Snow White, Rose Red, Sleeping Beauty, they're very sacred myths to our people. And they carry on, you know, deep traditions and values that really matter. And they do carry, if all you have to do is pick up a copy of Grimm's Fairy Tales and start reading it, the actual originals, to see that the gods are in there over and over again. And, you know, they take these movies, turn them into little cutesy cartoons that really don't have much value in them at all, and then put them, you know, on theaters all across the, you know, nation. And, you know, the America has a very Germanic population, at least back then, especially they did. So what was their intent?
Stan Lee, the man who wrote and created the Thor comics, he was a Jew.
Oh, yeah, okay. It's interesting. Why such a fascination with everything German?
Well, exactly. Yeah, that's the question.
I mean, you know, it's just, it's very strange. I mean, I've been a long-term, you know, listener of both of your shows. I really, really enjoy them. And, you know, of course, I've done a lot of research on my own, both in books and on the internet. And that question, it goes back so far. And, you know, it's a very sensitive topic, but you two don't shy away from that. I really am tired of shying away from it myself. But, you know, if you go back to 800 AD, there was a nation of people in the East, the Khazar Empire, and the Germans basically were, Germanic peoples were in constant skirmishes with them in that area. And at one point, they razed their entire city to the ground and slaughtered them. And these kind of things went on back then between peoples. And I've wondered myself, does it really go all the way back to that time?
I think this is a real old war. We have no idea how far back it goes, but I have my hunch. I'm looking into a few things, and I think that this is something that's quite ancient, and it's coming to a head, and maybe now we're just starting to see this agenda unfolding.
I think so, too. And it's actually very sad because, you know, growing up as a child in America, I believed in these beautiful ideals. I really believed what they tell us, and I thought that, naively, that our politicians were the most noble of the bunch, you know, and America was this great country, you know, doing all these wonderful things. And, you know, I believed in everything that I was taught over and over again in school and about history. And one thing that's always driven me is a search for the truth, regardless of how painful whatever you find may be. And I've always been willing to discard any belief that I have, no matter how treasured, if it doesn't hold up to scrutiny. And I really wish the world was the way that I grew up thinking it was. I don't want to believe what we're talking about right now is true. But when you look at the world events right now, it becomes undeniable. And the only way that you find it out is through shows like yours or through, you know, searching through YouTube to try to find individual videos showing you in each European nation what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. And once you really see it, and this actually happened to me very recently, it's, you can't deny it, and it's really a shock. And you think, my goodness, there really is a war against European people right now.
Yeah, I mean, there is, and people want to live in denial, or they want to turn around and say, you deserve it. They want to justify a cultural and ethnic genocide to people that never had anything to do with events of the past. And besides that, there's so much disinfo going around about, you know, slavery and the colonies and what was going on in history. And everyone just buys it hook, line, and sinker. Even people that are supposedly alters. They're just reiterating the mainstream garbage right now. It's just amazing.
They are, because, you know, the thing about human beings is that, you know, naturally, and this isn't necessarily a bad thing, but naturally we're magical thinkers. We think superstitiously, and we tend to believe what we're told. And, you know, a black cat crosses your path before you have a really bad day. And so the next day you think, well, I better not, you know, let that black cat cross my path again. Like, logic and critical thinking and reasoning skills are not necessarily something that comes naturally. You have to teach them to yourself or learn them in school. And we know that more and more they are not teaching people how to reason and how to think critically at all. They're just teaching people how to obey. And so even people who are in the alternative news community, it's just so much easier to just, you know, spout off what you've been told because it's so comforting than to actually receive anything someone says, no matter how absurd it might seem, and then dissect it with your logic. Look into it yourself and think, well, maybe that's appalling to me, but I'm going to do a little digging around and see, is there some truth to that?
Yeah, exactly. It's like when you look into the Holocaust or slavery, it should be a good thing that if you find out as many people didn't die or as many people weren't slaves or that everyone was slaves and you weren't just singled out, it should be a good thing. But people want to hang on to that because they're using it as a political weapon. And it's so obvious.
And if you repeat something over and over and over again, people will believe it's true and it becomes harder and harder to reject it. And, I think it's a miracle that I was able to free myself from Christianity, free myself from Judaism.
You went down that route, huh?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I liken it to a shaman's path because, you know, for a shaman, although this would be healing yourself, in order to retrieve a part of your soul or a part of their client's soul, the person they're healing, they have to descend all the way down to the underworld to find that piece of soul and take on the sickness of their client who they're healing, and then return back to the upper world. And so, you know, as a Christian, I took it as far as it could go. This is later in life, obviously, not when I was 12. I reverted to my Christian programming because when it's in there, you will revert. Because what will happen to you is you'll have something terrible happen to you, like you'll go through a breakup or you'll lose a job or you'll injure yourself. And it's burned in your consciousness, even if you've been practicing paganism for a while.
It's like, pray to Jesus right away.
You're desperate. You call out to Jesus, you know? And so I reverted back to Christianity for a long time. But what happened with that is I started doing research then, again, as an adult, and I started noticing all the inconsistencies and, you know, just the general embracing of ignorance that kind of typified the Christian community. And so I basically started searching for, like, where's the real Bible? That's one example. You know, everybody's always, most fundamentalists, they will say all day long that the King James Version is the authoritative Bible, right? Well, the thing is that when I did the research on my ancestors who came over here, I found out that they didn't actually carry the King James Bible. They carried the Geneva Bible with them. So I looked into the Geneva Bible and what was the difference between that and the King James Bible. And basically, King James didn't like all of the anti-monarchy sentiment in the Geneva Bible, so he had it rewritten to serve his own purposes. And so that got me thinking, well, where's the real Bible? How do I actually find it? And I concluded, well, it must be in the Greek. And to make a long story short, I ended up looking into Greek Orthodoxy. I actually started going to a Greek Orthodox church. And from then on, I looked into, you know, just really started studying it, learning all about Paul and what he taught and Jesus and what he taught. And then I started to notice that, wait, these two really conflicted with each other, Paul and Jesus. There was a real problem there.
So what do you think about the Bible? Is it mythology or did someone write it as a political tool? There's a lot of ideas I know you're familiar with. What are your thoughts?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, it really stems from Judaism. So you have these people, Semitic peoples living in, that area in the Middle East. And there's a lot of theories that monotheism came out of Egypt. That's definitely a possibility. You know, in the Bible, the Jews explain their history themselves, saying that they were living in Egypt for a long time. The people that later became the Jews, they also had their own beautiful pagan traditions that they abandoned. The worship of Asherah, the wife of Yahweh or El, and they actually had different gods. Yahweh was not the same thing as El, which any Jew or a very learned Christian knows that, you know, those are terms for God. And somewhere along the line, you know, if I were to just guess, I would say that it may have been kind of a patriarchal movement, a movement towards consolidating male power and making sure that you know who, you know, the father of your child is so you can pass on your belongings to that child. And so hence all the restrictive laws against, you know, sexual promiscuity and those kinds of things.
Yeah, it seems too with heathenry, there's no central authorities, there's no single organization. It's more for the anarchist types who believe in self-rule and I think they had to put the kibosh on that at some point. Like, okay, we got to push this other thing. So, you know, the New World Order is beginning a long time ago.
Oh, yeah, I completely believe that. And, you know, I, looking at it now, examining it now that I'm free of the bonds of Christianity, it appears to me that it was used by the Byzantine Empire and the Romans as the perfect way to inject this, you know, self-flagellating, you know, slave religion into these people, and then, you know, to basically appoint, you know, a priest to be by the side of every king. I mean, if you study history, you can see exactly how this worked, because the Byzantine and Roman Empire, well, Rome had fallen, but that was the new Roman Empire with the church. They had so much power, and they would basically, you know, bribe these big burly pagan kings and say, hey, you know, we'll play ball with you, but to do that, you have got to convert to Christianity and convert your people to Christianity. And here is our elected official, this priest, who will be by your side to influence, you know, all of your rulemaking and policies. And so slowly it spreads like this virus, you know, as they one by one abandon their traditions, and in a lot of cases with extreme bloodshed. You know, if you look at Charlemagne and the massive slaughtering of the Saxons that he committed when he was converting them to paganism. And then eventually it just becomes fear-based. You know, no one would ever admit that they worship the old gods anymore, not after the slaughter that, you know, all the slaughter and Inquisition and everything, even the witchcraft trials, I believe, were the last vestiges of paganism that they were trying to snuff out. And then here we are now where, you know, who knows how many Germanic heathens there are on the planet, but even now I don't think a lot of people would feel comfortable standing up and saying that that's what they believe, because they would be completely ostracized and demonized for it.
Yeah, I think there is a resurgence. I heard in Eastern Europe, which I was glad to hear, people are denouncing Christianity and going back into the old pre-Christian faith. And yeah, to have that kind of revival would be pretty powerful among the European people, I think.
I think it really would, too. I think, for me, I almost feel like that is the one element missing from the entire resistance I see happening now that would really unite people together, is to, you know, part of it, you've got to shake off the shame. You've got to shake off the guilt that has been pounded into you that, you know, and really, in most cases, you do not deserve. I had an incident the other day in my personal life that was like that. And, you know, part of that is the Christian programming, you know, and part of it is realizing that, wait, you know, when you look into these traditions, they're so beautiful, they're so rich, and full of such fantastic, beautiful symbolism, you know, and that comes from your people's soul. Like, they created that. That sprang from them, you know, and you're not having to superimpose some Middle Eastern cult of shame onto your soul, you know, like this fake thing anymore. Something happens to you when you read these myths, when you read Voluspa, which is how I got back finally and made the final break when I read the prophecy of the Cirrus in the Poetic Edda. When you read that, you can feel it resonate with you.
What happens in that story?
Oh, it's wonderful. I've got it right here if you'd like me to
read
a stanza or two. But what it is it's the opening of the Poetic Edda. The Poetic Edda, for anyone who doesn't know, is basically a collection of old heathen poems that were written down in Iceland. Iceland was the last nation to finally convert to Christianity in the year 1000 AD, and so they held on to these traditions at the forefront of their minds for a much longer time than a lot of other Germanic heathen people did. And Voluspa is when the god Odin goes to the seer, who is, when you read it, it seems to be her name was probably Heidi, or she says, calls herself Hive. But he goes to the seer to ask her to please recount to him how the world was created and what is to come. And she starts speaking, and the one that I read is Lee Hollander's translation. It's pretty popular. And I read it in a moment where I had gone all the way through the path of Christianity to the path of Judaism, thinking, oh, well, if Christianity isn't real, then maybe Judaism is the answer. And I had it's hilarious that I say this now, you know, I had embraced it whole hog, no pun intended. But, you know, I was eating kosher. I was keeping Shabbat. I was like, okay, I've got this. Just follow the rules and you win, you know, like just obey all the rules. And my boyfriend actually was the one who confronted me and was saying that he was worried about me.
Good boy. Good boy.
Yes, he is. And yeah, he was saying, you know, you're turning into this other person. You're saying
eat some bacon fast.
yeah, exactly. Can't you smell that? It's delicious. And I had to examine myself, and I finally made the break. And the first thing I did was to open up the book, Poetic Eda, that I had, and to read Voluspa. And by the time I was done with it, I could feel it. I was like, this is what's real for me. I'm done with this. I'm done with this other nonsense. Like, I am finally just going to completely embrace and have the courage to make that leap and embrace the beliefs of my ancestors and the ways of my ancestors. And, you know, to hell with the fear of hell. And all the fear and the sin and everything. Like, I know that's not real.
Yeah, actually, in the Bach saga, I think it was hell was a good place, right?
Exactly, it was. Hell was not a fiery inferno. And what's so funny about that is that, you know, even in, you know, hell, the concept of hell began with Christianity. If you really want to go back, it began with Zoroastrianism. But in Judaism, which Christianity came from, there is no concept of a fiery hell. They actually have a concept of the other world that's kind of similar to the Scandinavian hell that they called Sheol, which was a shadowy, kind of more dimly lit realm of the dead. And hell in the Scandinavian tradition, named after the goddess who is one of Loki's children who administers over it, is a place where those who die of old age and sickness go in between lives before. And yes, our people did believe in reincarnation. It's throughout their myths and their stories. But yeah, no, it was not a place of punishment by any means. If anything, it was a place of rest and healing for the soul in between your lives.
I know there's many recovering Christians listening out there, but how did you finally break through your Christian programming?
That is one thing that I've done a lot of thinking on, and I feel like I have a lot of experience with, because I fought, had to fight so hard against it. An analogy that I use is that your soul, your psyche, is like a garden, and, you know, Christianity becomes like a weed in that garden, or a vine that just kind of overgrows everything. And so even though you hack away at a little bit of it, you know, and you think that you're free of it, and now you're this pagan, or even, you know, you're this atheist or something else, it still remains there. It's, you really have to root it out. You have to find the roots of it in your psyche, follow it all the way down to find where it has its hold on you. And in most cases, you're going to find that it has its hold on you because it makes it so easy. It's very black and white thinking. It appeals to the kind of child in you who once a parent who's going to provide you with everything, and you don't have to do it yourself. So, you know, you have to think of that. You know, nobody wants to do more effort than is required for anything, right? And it's the same for spirituality, right? Christianity is comfortable because all you have to do is have faith and believe, repent when you sin, you know, read the Bible, have faith, convert others. It's pretty easy in that regard. But heathenry requires you to be strong. So, you know, first there's that, you know, realize that it's comforting for you because all the answers are provided. Also realize that fear is a huge part of it because, I mean, you go in any church and you're going to be lucky if you don't get away at some point with hearing about the threat of hell. You know, you are not a Christian. You're going to hell to burn an eternal hellfire, you know, and that's going to keep those seeds in your psyche, you know, also, it's just the fear, having the courage to make the break. You almost have to not, it's almost like you have to defy it and not have the fear that you're going to destroy yourself in the process. You have to make like a leap over the sword bridge full of courage into paganism. And, it really requires a lot of strength to do it.
I think for some people it's difficult if they grew up in it because it's ingrained in you as a child. You go to Sunday school, you're indoctrinated, you're mind controlled. So you have to undo the mind control, and it's a difficult process, but eventually it happens and you wake up and you're, I'm free.
Yeah, it happens. You wake up, you're free, you don't feel demons whispering into your ear, you know, at any chance encouraging you to lust after people or steal something. Or, you know, I think that one of the things that it's funny that Christianity does to you, or Judaism, any kind of black and white thinking religion.
Or Islam.
Islam is a perfect example, yeah. Right? Is that, you know, there people want to talk about whether there's an objective truth or a subjective truth. Is there any actual objective truth out there? And, you know, I think kind of the concept of the universe as a hologram, right? And whatever ideology you're using to, you know, magnify and look at it with is going to affect your experience of that universe. And so when you take on these religions, these Abrahamic religions, you actually affect your interaction with the universe. It does become a black and white world because you polarize your mind into thinking that you're supposed to aspire to this purity, right? This way of being that is impossible. And you only have to know any Christian or be a Christian to know it's impossible. And, you know, everything else becomes demonized. And then those things that normally would be natural drives, you know, they're not that bad. They have this weird attraction to them. So they become, you create that reality. It does become a world filled with temptation, you know. And I noticed when I became a pagan that went away. I mean, I was like, why am I not feeling like I have to police my thoughts constantly, you know, to think happy, good, forgiving, loving thoughts about my enemies. And it just kind of went away, and I got a much more holistic, you know, healthy view of things.
Yeah, this turn the other cheek attitude is going to make you be genocided, people.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I was saying earlier in a conversation, you know, just clearly that's the solution. Just love everyone, forgive everyone, you know, and for all the ladies in Europe, open your legs. It's fine. Just, you know, accept the enemy.
Yeah. Right?
Just roll on over.
Make love to Islam.
Yeah. You know, I can't wait to be Islamic, you know.
Ugh. You know, well,
go get a hijab. Who cares if you used to be able to walk down the street without being sexually harassed at every point?
Who are these European women who go for these terrible guys anyway? Wake up.
No, they're not. And the thing is that they, you know, I think that might be part of it too. In that instance, and, you know, here we're talking about, I assume, kind of the concept of grooming, right? Which is this practice that these men will do. Where they will look around for naive young girls and kind of, you know, seduce them and then take advantage of them, right? These Islamic men. And it's kind of like on a female, you know, individual level, what's happening when I talk about adopting the Abrahamic religions. So on the one hand, you have, you know, these poor men, these European men are constantly inundated with this propaganda, right? Constantly told that they're not allowed to say anything or they're racist, you know, cut off from any knowledge of their heroic and wonderful past, not encouraged to be that way anymore. And so they're walking around not knowing what to do. And then you have these women who naturally women are attracted to powerful men, right, who will provide for their needs, you know, fight for them, defend them. And here come these men from a very patriarchal culture who carry themselves, I'm sure, with amazing, you know, confidence and, you know.
Isn't that a blow in the face to the Swedish feminists? Wake up, you idiots.
Exactly. You know? I know. What have you done? What has the feminist movement done to
women, you know? Want a strong man. I don't care what they tell you. A straight woman wants a strong man.
I agree. I swear. Like, I see these, you know, the metrosexual hipster kind of movement being pushed upon these men now and think,
skinny, you know, jeans, V-necks, pastels. Oh, yeah. No thanks.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Yeah, I don't want a guy who's going to spend more time in the bathroom than me getting ready for the day. Come on.
I think, too, for some of these European women, they think now that it's politically correct to date non-European men. So they do They do it strictly from a mind control aspect. They've been programmed, not that they actually really want that. I think there's that factor as well.
There is that factor. I think about that a lot. I see that a lot. There is kind of an ideal now that, which I think is so ridiculous, that if you're a woman in a relationship, if you're a white woman in a European woman in a relationship with another, you know, white European man, that's nice, you know. But if you're a white woman and you're in a relationship with, say, a Muslim or someone, you know, that would be considered to be visually very different from you, then you're doing something more noble.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And there's also, you know, not to get off track, but that's also attached to the concept now of gender identity. You know, that's nice that you're heterosexual, but if you're gay, then you're doing something a little more noble. There's something more special.
Oh,
about
yeah.
You.
There's this show called Faking It. I'm going to do a review about it. And these two girls, this is the kind of stuff the kids are being programmed with now. There are these two girls and they're faking being gay because it will make them more popular. And it does.
Oh, well, yeah. Of
Everyone
course.
Thinks I mean, they're more special and popular.
Yeah. So, yeah, I do want to go back to what you're talking about with, you know, the relationships up there. But just to, you know, go into that a little bit. I mean, I remember as a child, you're so kind of confused as a kid. You know, a lot of what you learn about how to be, you learn by imitating, you know, other people of your gender in your family. You know, you have an older cousin, you kind of watch her mannerisms and try to be ladylike like her, you know, and, you know, you imitate the people around you. And, you know, in the media, of course, we imitate, you know, our idols, we imitate, you know, these people, and we learn from them patterns of behavior. So, you know, when you're a child, you don't even know yet, you know, how you're going to lean later. Of course, those things are going to influence you, especially if every pop star is like, you know, this slutty, crazy, you know, wearing a meat suit, you know, making out with everybody. Like, you're going to want to be like her, you know?
She's so liberated, but, Elizabeth.
Yeah, I know. What's wrong with me? but no, yeah, with the relationships, you know, and these women who are going for these Islamic men or things like that. Yeah, it is really strange. You know, I mean, in France, for example, with this métissage movement by Sardowski or whatever his real name is, I don't know. But, you know, they're putting up posters everywhere, like kind of forcing people, like encouraging people, like, mm-hmm. you know, that's the noble thing to do now.
Brown, if you're a white woman, having a brown baby is the best thing you can do for humanity.
Yeah, it is. And I actually had someone kind of present that to me the other day as if they, because their child was, you know, of mixed heritage, that they were somehow doing some great noble thing and making the world better. And the thing is that, you know, I'm not against that. You know, I mean, love is a mysterious force that can touch anyone at any time. You can fall in love with who knows what, you know, who knows, you know, whether it's the same gender, the opposite, you know, that happens, you know, it might be someone from a completely different culture, and that's no problem. But what it is it's this mind control,
exactly.
brainwashing, you know, that it's supposed to happen on a massive scale.
Exactly.
And that's where I have a problem with it, especially when it's a political agenda to, you know, using the concept of love to brainwash people into, you know, leaning a certain way, because behind the scenes, the real motivation is to wipe out this culture, which through the ages has shown to be the most threatening to your machinations, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, you nailed that one. But genocide's not going to make anything better.
And it's not.
And it's also genociding other races, too. But we're all going to be just a blend of a little bit of everything, so then we're nothing, really.
For nothing. They want to homogenize everyone into completely non-individualized units, like the true battery of the Matrix, so that you have no roots to a culture, to anything that distinguishes you. You have no connection to either gender. You can go whichever way is required at the time. And imagine if you were this, you know, psychopathic emperor who wanted to come up with the best way to rule people, that's exactly how you would do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was a kid, I remember we would have an international day, you know, where everybody would pick a country and they would make a dish and dress up in a traditional costume and, you know, present their country and talk about all the beautiful traditions of that country and what makes them so unique. And I thought, wow, I took away from that we live in such a beautiful world because we really do have so many different traditions that give each of us strength, you know, and now I look and I see that there's obviously an agenda to destroy that, not just with white Europeans, but with everybody. Because if you look at it, you know, that may be the most obvious now, but everybody is a target. And, you know, the culture that they want to give us is their perfect packaged, you know, corporate consumer culture. So your culture now is, you know, the ad that comes on with the little xylophone in the background and the lady singing la 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 la.
Oh god, yeah. You know, I think I know the commercial.
Yeah, and having an iPod, you know, and it's like, you know, this hipster weird kind of vapid empty plastic culture. You know, that's what they want everybody to think?
I think now, even though Christianity, sure, there's some old stuff embedded in there, but even now that stands in the way because it still carries some old mythology. So even that has to be destroyed now. Don't you notice now they want to bring in this egalitarianistic religion?
Oh, yeah, yeah, they are attacking that. And yeah, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think that most, like, really, like, I mean, you may be on a list if you're a very fervent and fundamental Christian. Like, you know, I mean, there's a demonization of that, too, because I think that, you know, America as a nation, you know, has such a strong tradition to Christianity if you go back far enough. And I don't think that they want to encourage, I don't think that the people running things across the globe, I'm not speaking out against the American government per se, but they don't want to encourage anything that would make people passionate about the way things used to be mm-hmm. and return to that. They want to kind of, my feeling is they want everybody to kind of have this fatigue and malaise about the past and be looking to them to give them like the hope for the future, which is, as you say, this egalitarian, you know, kind of new religion.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Culture stands in the way, race stands in the way from this utopia oneness that, of course, we know will never exist.
No, yeah, it will never exist, unfortunately. And the only way it would ever exist is if you actually, well, geez, you'd have to get rid of the entire concept of corporations having anything to do with rulemaking of any kind and have, you know, free energy and actually use the technology we have to create this utopian world, which it appears is entirely possible if the people were actually in control. That's the only way we'd have it. And even then, I mean, the human nature will always have that darker side to it. You're always going to have, you know, crime against one another, skirmishes, wars of some kind. It's just
the way it is.
Yeah.
So how would you see integrating paganism into our modern world? Because a lot of people think that when we talk about that, we're talking about returning back to living like peasants. But I mean, I'm saying we could still trade and enjoy technology, et cetera. We don't have to go back to, you know, the Stone Age.
No, yeah, we don't need to go back to the Stone Age, you know. And one way to look at it is to take a very ancient religion that existed, you know, at the same time, even, you know, that these Germanic and Celtic traditions evolved and actually has similar roots to the Indo-European traditions that has survived into modern times without much intervention, which would be Hinduism, you know. And if you look at ancient Hinduism, you know, they had their Vedic fire rites that they held on mountaintops and, you know, long recitation of chants. And now you take your modern Hindu and, you know, they will have a little household shrine of their own, you know, where they might burn a little incense or pray a little bit to their god. Like, it doesn't have to be a return to, you know, the return to the groves, you know, mm-hmm. and like, you know, making blood runes and doing all this reenactment stuff. It doesn't have to be that. And it shouldn't really be that, you know, that the past is the past. We should evolve as a people. And what I imagine would be a wonderful way to see it is I think that people should learn about, you know, all the beautiful mythology from the past and also learn how to make it current. So for example, you just think of the people in your family who have passed on, who you love, who are dear to you. And you can even start that simply. You just, you know, take a picture of grandpa and grandma, you know, and it's very simple. You know, you just light a couple candles, put out a nice bowl and maybe some greenery or, you know, a rock that has meaning to you, something to connect you to the natural world. And just from the heart, you know, take that time to, you know, speak to them, to do what our ancestors traditionally did, which was to offer a little bit of food or a little bit of, you know, ale or mead or even cream and milk in a lot of cases was used, or their favorite beverage. If grandma loved tea, you know, offer some tea and, you know, just to recover those traditions. You know, even Jacob Grimm in his German Mythology, which is a 4-volume tome that I just began reading, he covers these traditions of the people and how that really is the simplest way. They didn't always have a huge temple they would go to, like in the Vikings, although that was beautiful, to go see, you know, Odin and Frey and Thor as these huge gods and do this crazy huge ritual. Often it was just something done in the house, you know, just to recognize your connection to your family, connection to nature, and to honor your connection to your people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm big on tradition, but now I see that word being demonized. Do you? Now people think it's some conservative right-wing idea.
They do. They do. And what's so funny is I was thinking about even what you said, right wing, right? When I was a kid, I remember that left and right, neither one was awful. It was like some people leaned more to conservatism. Some people wanted to change things dramatically, right? They were left. But now we're so brainwashed into thinking, you know, right wing is evil, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tradition is evil, right? Like, how did that happen? Why? You know, because really what you're talking about is a psychological, you're talking about a mode of thinking. Do we want to remain doing the things that we always did, right? That would be traditionalism. Or do we want to change things? That would be liberalism. And really everybody falls in between. Sometimes one's necessary. Sometimes another is necessary. But it's weird that we're completely throwing aside any traditionalism as something that's evil, that's terrible. Because, I mean, are you saying that our ancestors were idiots, all of them?
Yeah, exactly.
They never, like, what? I mean,
these are people that you came from, so then you're calling yourself an idiot.
Yeah, you're just, which is exactly what they want. And look what they're doing to, you know, the European people everywhere. You know, you're lambasted for decrying any, you know, pride in your ancestors and history. It's just, you know, faces just jaws drop if you say anything like that. So,
well, you know what? Let the jaws drop. Let's all start being louder. You know, enough of this. It's time to be loud about this. I don't care what people call me. You can call me whatever you want. I don't give a damn, you know?
Good for you. I know. And there's that courage. There's a courage that you're showing that's been, you know, stomped out of our people for so long. You know, I don't care what people say either anymore, because the thing is you can play along and you can play along for so long, right? And
mm-hmm.
that's fine. But do I see an actual beautiful world being created with these ideals that they're forcing down everyone's throats? No, I don't. I see the exact opposite. And the thing is that now we're backed into a corner. It's to a point where you look and you realize that the person that, you know, the force that has been doing this to you is actually your enemy
mm-hmm.
and has your annihilation right at hand. That's their goal. And so, no, it's time to speak up.
Yeah, I think that if you stay quiet, the force will not reward you. It will end up at your door and you're going to have to fight it one way or another. But if you're bold and you step out and you start speaking and you start living how you want to live and say what you want to say, the force will be with you.
It will. Yes. I mean, I'm just so amazed that really that, I mean, I only started speaking up about these things in my own personal life and community very recently. And the reaction I get is so emotional and angry and dismissive that it makes me ever more determined to talk about it more, because, you know, I had no idea that basically the feeling that I get is, you know, as long as you know, and I'm getting a bit racial here because that's what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, little white person, as long as you sit in your seat quietly and hang your head sheepishly and know your place, then you're fine. And we'll play along with you and you're accepted. But the minute that you don't know your place and you dare to not adhere to all of these PC rules that, you know, we've laid down for you to follow, then it's like, it's on. I've noticed that as soon as you start saying anything.
Yep. That's why I think, I mean, I'm not a collectivist. I'm definitely more independent, and a lot of whites are rebellious and independent. That's why we don't have this unity right now, but I see that we need to start getting a powerful core together to resist this attempted genocide. So we got to connect with like-minded people. We got to make contact. We got to build up networks. We got to plan this resistance out more. We got to start reaching out now.
I agree with you. And, you know, there's a lot of challenges with that, because the first instinct when you're backed into a corner, like, think about this, right? You know, everybody's very civil when there's nothing to be fought over. You know, everybody's friends, everybody's very civil. But, you know, in any time of war, the moment that, you know, war is at hand and you face the enemy, it's instinctive to immediately dehumanize the enemy, right?
Mm-hmm.
To demonize them, make them out to be something, you know, really terrible, because it makes it easier for you to deal with the grim reality of fighting against them. And it strengthens you. Anger is a strengthening force. And one thing that I think is a challenge is that once you start looking towards ideas of European identity, you know, or dare I say nationalism, things like that, you're going to find a lot of people who, you know, they are so fed up and so angry that it's very easy to fall into the black hole of, you know, really embracing this sense of actual, real, authentic racism, where, mm-hmm. you know, you start, because you're so fired up about it, that and you that you start thinking, well, maybe all the old racial slurs and beliefs about, you know, everybody, you know, and then you start getting into the realm of, you know, white supremacy and stuff like that. And, you know, for me personally, I feel like that's a really dark path. It's like, what we want to do is be an example to other people who know that they're struggling with the same issues, to be an example on how to preserve and maintain your roots, recover your traditions without threatening others,
sure.
you know, without denigrating others, so that they can do the same. I mean, the only people that you really need to turn your full fury and wrath against are those who really are perpetuating this war against
well,
you,
exactly.
because they deserve it.
Yep. And when I say resistance, it doesn't mean violence, but it means standing up and not taking the crap anymore, just calling a spade. And I have to say,
yeah.
after I interviewed Tim Murdoch, and a whole new crowd contacted me, and they are some of the coolest people I have ever met.
Yeah.
And they're not violent. They're very well-rounded and cool, and they see what's going on. So they're definitely not white supremacists like people try and say. They just want to be left alone. They want everyone to be left alone, in fact. So
I know. That was such an amazing interview, and that's kind of what led me into finding out what was really going on. That combined with Henrik's presentation on Sweden really opened my eyes. And I was aware initially, the first time I ever even heard about any of this was the nation of Greece and what mm-hmm. they've been through.
Yeah.
And that was just horrifying to really see what has been done to those people.
Yeah.
And then, hearing about Sweden, and then I started thinking, well, wait, what about all the other countries? So all I did is I started searching on every traditionally European country and the issue of immigration that I could find, and one after another I saw that the exact same thing is happening in every nation. And just watching these videos of these cities completely overrun with people from they're from a completely different world and culture.
Oh, yeah.
And the hearing about that women in Sweden have to dye their hair mm-hmm. to try to
cover up.
My gosh, it's so great. And then, and then the girl in Brussels who did her documentary, that was incredible too. She can't even walk down the street in a respectable dress without being propositioned left and right by these men. I mean, it's
And here's what I don't get. These lefty feminists, they're quiet now. They don't say anything. They seem to actually embrace Islam. What the hell is that about?
Oh, yeah. What's with that? That's the next wave, right? Super sensitivity to Islam. I mean, didn't they use that as it's like whatever serves their purpose, they use that at first to justify all this war, right? There's Islam, the enemy, like they're such terrible people. But then now we're being called to switch gears, right?
Mm-hmm.
Open your hearts and, like I said earlier, sorry to be vulgar, but open your hearts and lift up your skirts and, welcome Islam. Like
It's schizophrenic, and people are supporting them. I thought people were for gay rights and women's rights on the left, and all of a sudden they're just forgetting about that and embracing Islam in Europe. It doesn't make any sense to me.
It doesn't make any sense, and the only sense that it makes is if it's not an actual ideology springing out of intelligence, logic, and wisdom, but instead it's just a propaganda tool construct used to manipulate people. Like then that's the only way it makes sense.
Yeah. I only see this ending one way, and that's nationalist anarchy. I see things breaking off. It's just inevitable at this point. The tension is mounting, and people are going to say, I don't want to live like this. There was already a white flight out of London. 600,000 whites left into the countrysides. So,
wow.
But that's good. We shouldn't be in the cities. Let's leave it anyway. Let's go start something new.
No, I know. And, cities throughout the globe have always, in all times, they've always been multicultural, usually not slanted as badly as London and Oslo, places like that have become now. But, those big cities are where trade is done, and actually traditionally we're a more agrarian, people connected to the land. So, like you say, no, it makes sense for us to leave the cities in the future. I mean, I think that, I watched something recently, it was a convention with Nick Griffin talking. It was like some kind of nationalist
mm-hmm.
convention.
Yeah.
And what's funny is to see these people who are so demonized and called neo-Nazis, and they're so terrible, talking together about a brotherhood of European nations, you know, and that to me harkened back to that International Day when I was in sixth grade, and I thought, wow, that sounds really beautiful. So you're all recognizing your separate beautiful traditions and willing to fight for the right to have, you know, a Greek Greece, you know, a British England, a French France, and you know, unite to preserve these traditions. How is that bad? How is that evil?
It's not. They're nationalists for every color.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it's just, gosh, it's so disheartening to see what's going on, but it's so uplifting when you start seeing that people are waking up. You know, people are realizing it. People are not as silent as the media would like us to believe. And as you say, it is inevitable, you know, and I think that it can be done in a way, hopefully, that does not require bloodshed and, you know, firing in the streets. I mean, just looking at how Greece is leaning more and more towards, you know, getting away from the EU is one example, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think this is going to push us to a good place collectively as Europeans. I think we're going to walk away from our corrupt governments. Some people probably are going to need to be dealt with, though. We'll have to take back control of the military and the technology, and then we're going to have to dismantle into smaller colonies from there. That's how I see it going out.
No, I hear you. That sounds like it's that's very possible how it might play out. I mean, eventually there's going to be uncomfortable, you know, parts of it. It's not going to be all just,
of course not.
You know, yesterday we were, you know, dealing with all this, and now, you know, everything's delightfully perfect. It can't be that way.
I'd rather be out somewhere in the country with people I like and hold the fort and protect the land than have to deal with what I'm dealing with now with government and all this multicultural madness and violence.
Me too. I know. People have forgotten what real culture is, you know. Everybody's so exhausted with the world and the state of things, and they go to their jobs and they get, you know, if they have one, and they come home, they engage in whatever kind of mind-numbing behavior they can and hope for the best. And, you know, it's just, you know, they listen to their pop music, and, you know, which is ever more robotic, creepily, and, you know, watch their propaganda movies and everything. And they forget that, you know, real culture involves, you know, gathering around a bonfire and everybody singing songs, pulling out a few instruments, you know, and sharing stories, you know, or, you know, local music, you know, it's like they don't even know how to do that. Getting together and having potlucks. When's the last time anyone did that? I mean, people still do, but, you know, we would not lose anything if we just completely snubbed all of the mass media entertainment and came up with our own entertainment.
So are there any sources you can recommend for people who want to look more back into heathenism?
Well, yeah, actually, since I've spent so much time sifting through so much, I can definitely come up with a few that I think are probably the best to start with. One that's a little hard to find, but I have to say it's probably one of the best out there, is a book called Teutonic Religion. It was written by, I'm sure I'll say his name wrong, but Veldolf Gundarsson. But you don't really need to know that. You can find it. There's only one place to get it online, actually, in ebook form. It's Freya Aslan's site, which I think is www.freyaaslan, that's ASWYNN.com, and she sells it there. The others I would recommend would be get your hands on a copy of the Poetic Edda, because that is almost the closest thing to, like, the Bible of our ancestor traditions, really. Those two are good to start with. Also, Grimm's fairy tales, you know, read them, read the actual fairy tales and see the beauty contained within these ancient stories that we used to tell our children in the old days.
Have you looked into Slavic mythology at all? Is it pretty similar to the Germanic heathenism?
That's really interesting, because only kind of barely did I look into it enough to notice that there were a ton of similarities, actually. Yeah, it looked like there were a lot of similarities with the Slavic traditions. I saw some kind of wooden, you know, object where the guy had one eye closed, you know, he almost looked like Woden, and I thought, well, that's interesting. So yeah, I think you would probably find a lot of similarities with Slavic heathenism, with Germanic heathenism. Yeah.
I'm going to start diving into that. I'm looking for some good people to introduce that subject.
Oh, that does sound fascinating.
Because we don't hear much from Eastern Europe. I feel like with the language barrier and stuff, you can't go online and just find the stuff as easy as Western Europe. Everyone speaks English.
Yeah, I know. I think that's kind of a problem, too. No, I would love to hear that topic tackled.
As we begin to wrap up here, is there anything else you wanted to share?
So when I found out kind of through all my research what was going on in the world today and everything, I was just really overwhelmed with this deep sadness. And in a moment that I can only describe as a come to Woden moment, when I was out in nature, I kind of called out from the depths of my soul to the All-Father, Woden, saying, basically asking, please, that if there's any way that I could help in this struggle, you know, if I had anything to offer, any gifts that, you know, I had to offer to people to guide them or help them in any way, to please use me and give me a voice somehow to use my knowledge to contribute. And that was actually the very day that you invited me on your show later on.
Oh, wow. That's great. I love hearing that.
Yeah.
Well, that's special. Thanks for sharing that. All right. Well, please let people know how they can reach you.
I think for now, probably you can probably just contact me on Facebook. I'm under the name Elizabeth Holgrave, so you can find me on there. And pretty soon, I've been encouraged for a long time to do this. I've been thinking of starting my own radio show.
Cool.
So maybe we can link to that at a later time.
Awesome. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lana. It's really been a pleasure talking with you tonight.
The word paganism has acquired a pejorative meaning, often associated with childish behavior of some obscure New Age individuals carrying burning torches or reading the entrails of dead animals. This is a false conception of the original meaning of paganism. Pagans, or polytheists, included scores of thinkers from antiquity who were not at all like many self-proclaimed pagans worshipping animals or gazing at the sun. Being a pagan denotes a method of conceptualizing the world beyond the dualism of either-or. The plurality of gods means the plurality of different beliefs and different truths, so if you're a Christian, then you can worship your god. But the pagans never fought about whose gods were better, and except for Diocletian, they didn't make an effort to persecute the Christians either. The Vikings acted in retaliation to Christian violence. Thinking in terms of conspiracy to sever people from their roots, it's no wonder that ancient European myths, legends, and folktales are often ridiculed by scholars, including some Christian theologians who claim to see in them gross enactments of European barbarism, superstition, and sexual promiscuity. I'd encourage you to start reading them and discover for yourself. I don't know about you guys, but I feel strongly inspired to dig into the folklore, mythology, and traditions of my ancient ancestors. A revival is beginning to spark in the hearts of Europeans, even though darkness surrounds them. European people are hungry for cultural and spiritual depth and for unity, a revival of true European heritage, not the false foisted Western culture we currently see. We soon may be witnessing the dawn of the blossoming of old cultures, a return to the roots that are directly tied to our ancient European precursors. Thanks for listening, and of course you can find Radio 314 and myself on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. And I want to say thank you to our Red Ice members who make our programs possible. We do appreciate you. Bye for now.
Yeah.